Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome back to True Crimes Podcast. Today I have a very interesting show, and my guest is John Collins from the Forensics Foundation Group, ForensicFoundations.com or CrimeLabReport.com. And he's with us today to discuss his report regarding How would I describe it? Lost my center there. Sorry, John. How are you today?
That's okay. No, we Crime Lab Report is a publication that really serves the forensic science community, and we do a lot of media and industry analysis of various issues affecting the forensic sciences. And one of those issues is the overturning of previous convictions and the use of forensic science in those cases, either during the original trial or during the post-conviction litigation. So we've been involved in reporting on erroneous convictions, how they occur, and what they mean for many years.
Yes, okay, I got the title here, The Wrongful Conviction of Forensic Science, that you
Correct.
Wrote with Jay Jarvis. Okay.
That's right.
Now,
that's right.
Can you tell us, give us a little background on you? So,
sure.
How you got involved in this?
Yeah, well, I got involved in forensics really before it was very popular. I was really, as a youngster, I was 13 years old when the 20th anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination occurred, and I really got wrapped up in all of the conspiracy theories, like a lot of people do, and the forensic aspects of the investigation, and that really kind of whetted my appetite for the field. And so I graduated from the forensic science program at Michigan State University, which at the time was one of the major forensic science programs in the country, and then started my career with the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, so in Atlanta, and their headquarters laboratory. So my technical background is actually in what people often know as ballistics or firearm identification. And then I spent some time with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Lab at Atlanta, and then worked in suburban Chicago for a while, and then finished my laboratory career with the Michigan State Police, where I was the director of forensic science for the Michigan State Police for 2.5 years. And so I oversaw the 7 laboratories of the Michigan State Police, and they're about 260 people in the labs. And then started my own practice. So I do a lot of teaching now, and teaching workshops for professional development of forensic science professionals.
Great. So you have a long career in this.
Very long career and interesting career, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. And in your paper that you wrote, it's very interesting. You went through the history of how you felt you witnessed forensic science and how, you know, it started out being it's always been fascinating to people, and it started out being
right.
really. People really admire it and want to know more about it and think it's the answer to getting justice. But
yeah,
I noticed that it was, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you know, to your point, and that can be both good and bad, that there's a perception that forensic science is perfect, or that it should be perfect, and there's no such thing as perfect. And so, you know, public perceptions about the use of science in litigation, the use of scientific evidence, it affects the field because the public expectations will shape how forensic science is practiced. And if those expectations are unreasonable, then it sends us down a road that will be tough to recover from. And so we write about those types of issues in Crime Lab Report.
Yes. And when did you notice that things started to turn against or should I say that? Do you feel like public perception has turned against forensic science nowadays?
Yeah. Well, that's a great question. It's kind of got a two-part answer. First of all, I say this when I teach a lot, that if I go to a party and I tell somebody that I'm a forensic scientist, they don't look at me, they don't roll their eyes and look at me suspiciously. They say, oh, wow, that's interesting. You know, I mean, so forensic science, and when we use the word public, we're talking about people sitting around their dinner tables. You know, there's not a widespread public concern about forensic science capabilities or the practice of forensic science. Where the problem is amongst individuals who have really grown frustrated with our criminal justice system. They want to reform it to fit their particular ideological views. And make no mistake, it is very, very ideological. And so forensic science, to the extent that it tends to inflate public confidence in the reliability of our criminal justice system, they don't, if their goal is to reform criminal justice system, they don't want public confidence. And so they will do whatever they can to make sure that public confidence in the criminal justice system is as low as possible. And that's where the bias and the conflict of interest comes in. And so as far as what many journalists write about forensic science and what attorneys that are very outspoken and innocence activists that are trying to overturn convictions, these individuals have an end game in mind, and that is complete reform of our criminal justice system. So forensic science is a problem for them. And that's not to say that forensic science is perfect. We have issues that we're working out, but it's part of the overall evolution of the field. And I think, and I'm very confident in saying that our criminal justice system is much, much better because of forensic science, not worse. And that's really, I think, the message that probably we as forensic science professionals need to get out more.
And how about these, but at the same time, though, certain like innocence groups that you mentioned, they tend to try to discredit the forensic science.
Yes, and there, you know, first of all, one thing that I want to say, be real clear about, is that many of these innocence advocates or what are called post-conviction litigators or post-conviction advocates, they do a lot of great work out there, and they represent individuals that really have a strong, compelling case of innocence. So I don't want to portray them as you know, problematic or corrupt across the board. Their efforts, in many cases, their efforts to disparage the profession of forensic science or disparage individuals that work in the forensic sciences is part of a campaign. And I wish that they would admit it, but they don't. And the reality is, as I said before, they are trying to reform the criminal justice system to meet their expectations. And there may be a lot of validity to that, and I respect that. But what I don't respect as a forensic science professional is I don't respect the intentional misleading of the public about something as important as scientific evidence for the purpose of satisfying a campaign. And that, in my opinion, is what's happening too often.
Right, because it's sort of a fine line. It's like you want to free innocent people, but at the same time, you don't want them using the same arguments to try to free someone who may not be innocent.
Right. Well, and you know, and you could, exactly, and you actually have another conflict of interest that I think is pretty significant, and that is that ever since the O.J. Simpson trial and when the innocence movement, as they say, got off the ground, it became in vogue, and so there are, I really don't know what the number is, if it's you know, definitely scores, if not hundreds, of innocence clinics around the country that they try to raise funds to keep themselves in business, and they need to justify themselves. And innocence clinics aren't going to stay in business if they're not getting exoneration. And what we've seen, and maybe this parlays into the, another part of the discussion, is that, you know, what we have, Jay Jarvis, my colleague and I, have seen in some of the research that we've done on some fairly high-profile exonerations is that there are some pretty shady tactics that are being employed by some of these innocence activists to secure exonerations. And it is really, really troubling. And in some cases, it costs the public millions of dollars in reparations that if they come from what we might call an unjustified exoneration, that's a lot of losses, a lot of damage done to the public through some of these tactics. And, you know, we're still studying it, but it's the love affair that some have with the innocence movement is going to be coming to an end in the next few years. And maybe we can start to get to a more logical, reasonable discussion about our criminal justice system and overturn convictions as opposed to an ideological one.
So what happened with OJ? Could you just give us tell us what happened there that lifted up the innocence?
Yeah, OJ Simpson was really, I mean, that was an anomaly. That was a major international spectacle occurring in one of the world's largest cities, Los Angeles, that was heavily reliant upon a very new and emerging forensic technology, that being DNA evidence. And back then, investigators and attorneys and even forensic science professionals themselves didn't fully understand the nuances of DNA evidence and what it meant and so forth. And so as those of us that remember watching that case, that there were problems with the DNA evidence, and O.J. Simpson's defense team were very successful in convincing the jury that problems with the evidence against OJ, and therefore he was eventually acquitted. Well, what happened was that two of the attorneys that were pivotal in OJ Simpson's defense, and that was Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, very respected defense attorneys and creators of the Innocence Project in Manhattan, they were really successful in the wake of the OJ Simpson trial using their notoriety to really start an entire cottage industry of overturning convictions, and many of them were legitimate exonerations. And so I really kind of look to the O.J. Simpson trial as the beginning of the birth of the innocence movement, and that it's really been chugging along, you know, without slowing down up until now.
So now why do you think, okay, so it took off then and it's been strong and a lot of innocence programs have been coming up around the country, and they, like you said, they usually are associated with universities.
Yeah, the ones that I'm familiar with, they're affiliated with law schools, and in some cases they're affiliated with journalism schools, which is another problem in and of itself. And I think even within the innocence movement, they've recently started to not encourage innocence clinics to be affiliated with journalism schools because of the conflict of interest. But they're typically affiliated with law schools, and what they do is they provide a great clinical environment for law students to study cases and then potentially even get involved in cases where they feel that there's a real strong possibility that the individual that has filed a claim of a wrongful conviction may actually be innocent. And so they begin the process of conducting investigations, and in many cases, they are successful in convincing authorities that there's an innocent person in prison and they're released.
And is there any oversight on this, and who funds these programs?
No, there is absolutely no oversight. And it's interesting because post-conviction litigation, which is the, if you were to give it a name, that's actually what we're talking about. Post-conviction litigation is really the field of endeavor that is involved with overturning previous convictions, is that it exists in a really strange gray area in the law where it bounces back and forth. So if you, for example, have an attorney that is a post-conviction litigator and is investigating a claim of innocence, there's this really strange bouncing between the practice of law and the practice of social activism. And so in terms of the law profession, you know, the various, you know, for example, the American Bar Association, which is supposed to be the, you know, the premier defender of legal practice, well, if you're talking about the practice of law, then yes, they have standing in those issues. But if you're talking about social activism, they really don't. And so these activists that work towards the exoneration of prisoners or previously convicted defendants, there's no oversight in the social activism side of things, mainly because of freedom of speech and a lot of constitutional issues that are very complicated. But there are no standards for these cases. These investigators that go and they interview witnesses that testified, for example, 20 years ago, they can be remarkably effective at, you know, in the worst case scenarios, bullying people into recanting their testimony or confessing to crimes that they never committed, just for the purpose of getting somebody exonerated and getting them out of prison. And it's really disturbing, and I think it's a public safety problem. And nobody is really looking at it very seriously except for those of us involved with Crime Lab Report, but I think that this is an issue that needs to get into the mainstream press and needs to be scrutinized because it is a real serious problem, and our entire criminal justice system stands to be reformed based upon some of these tactics, and that should be really troubling to anyone that's worried about public safety.
Right, because they have the clout of being lawyers, right? They're normally lawyers who are,
right,
and they're used to be social activists for certain people, so that has a lot of, you know,
right,
clout. Now, how are they normally funded? Do you know? Does the government, is there funding this, or is it all private?
Well, I think, you know, it probably depends. I don't entirely know the answer to that, but what I do know is that it really varies. It depends on the clinic, its location. I suspect, at least to the best of my knowledge, some of these clinics are funded by the actual schools because they're providing a really interesting educational environment for the students. So it's part of a curriculum, and it's a great learning experience for these students. And there's no doubt about that, what a great experience these innocence clinics can be for law students. In the case of, for example, on, you know, at the higher end, the flagship Innocence Project in Manhattan, they do a lot of fundraising. They are so well known and so popular that their funds get into the millions and millions of dollars. And even their co-directors also have a private legal practice on the side, where in some cases they're representing these individuals that they got out of prison in the cases where they're trying to sue for reparations. And so you're talking more millions of dollars. And so this is a big business, this innocence movement, and the funds are coming from a lot of different sources. So you really kind of have to look at their financials to really see where it's coming from.
And in your paper, you gave examples, or in your talk, about some of people that were exonerated that maybe were not innocent, that went on to commit other crimes.
Right. Yeah, and it's, you know, it's tough to say, really, and I'll be the first to admit, it's difficult to say how prolific these examples are, but they're troublesome enough, and there's clearly tactics being used by some of these innocence activists to provide enough concern that we should be looking at these to say, gosh, of all of these exonerations that have taken place, let's say over the last 15 to 20 years, if we really looked at these, and you know, what might we find in terms of the number of truly guilty defendants that were exonerated for whatever reason? So the cases that have really caught our attention is the All-Story Simon case up in Illinois, which they made a movie about, which is really, it's a documentary and it's a great movie to watch, called Murder in the Park. And the other case that we're really interested in is the Gregory Taylor exoneration in North Carolina. Taylor is a case that the media have not really looked at yet through a critical prism, but some of the tactics that we saw in the Gregory Taylor, looking at transcripts and you know, case records and so forth, some of the tactics that were used to exonerate Gregory Taylor, for which he was later awarded millions of dollars in reparations, were very similar to the ones that were used up in the All-Story Simon case. And so those are the two that have given us the most interest. There's a couple others that we are just in the very early phases of looking at, but we're also trying to get some resources to help us fund our investigation because it's very time-consuming. But suffice it to say that what we see is that some of the tactics that innocence activists will accuse police of, for example, coercing confessions, you know, misleading witnesses and so forth, as being a causative factor in erroneous convictions, we're seeing the same behavior from some innocence activists. And that's really a shame, because I think what these innocence activists could do is serve as a better example for how to work with witnesses and suspects and so forth in a more responsible fashion. But in many cases, we're seeing some pretty shady tactics. But I would really encourage your listeners, if you're really interested in a fascinating case, is to look at the case records for the Gregory Taylor exoneration in North Carolina. It's very eye-opening. And we've written about it in Crime Lab Report.
Okay, so you can get that on your website?
Yeah, just go type in crimelabreport.com, and in the Crime Lab Report menu, you'll see the Innocence Audit, and we have some articles there about some cases.
Okay. Great. Do you want to talk some more, or did you want to? I know you're driving.
Yeah,
right
how about
now, right?
Another? It's up to you, but how about we go till 1:30, and then we'll probably when I'm going to be starting to get off the highway here.
Yeah, because now you're talking about shady tactics. Now it makes me think that is this because they're trying to take on police investigations without the police expertise going on?
Well, when we talk about shady tactics, I'm glad you asked that question, because I think what we're really talking about are it's investigative methods that are being motivated by an overwhelming desire to secure an exoneration without enough attention being paid to whether or not that's the right thing to do and whether or not it's really justified. And so we see some of these tactics used really in a couple different ways. The first is, obviously, if you have somebody that's in prison who's claiming innocence and there's an effort to secure that individual's exoneration, then getting a confession from a completely different person for that crime is probably one of the best ways that you can secure an exoneration, by, you know, getting a confession from another person. So that would be strategy number one in the innocence. Strategy number two is to get witnesses from the original trial who gave incriminating statements or incriminating testimony, to get those witnesses to recant their original testimony. So it could be 20 years later, you have a couple individuals that testified against a defendant who was later convicted, and then you get some innocence activists that descend on this individual 15, 20 years later and start to get that individual to believe that, gosh, maybe I did give bad testimony, and in some cases bully them into admitting that their original testimony was fraudulent, and then sign some type of an affidavit or sworn statement that, yes, I'm recanting my testimony because it was erroneous. Those are very effective ways to start to get the innocence or the exoneration wheels turning. And so what we will see and what we have seen in some of these transcripts is what we feel is the bullying of individuals to confess to crimes that they never committed or to coerce or manipulate or bully witnesses into recanting their previous testimony. And it's just, it's a shame. I don't know how to, it's very troublesome. We try to look at it professionally, but as a taxpayer and a husband and a father, it's very, very upsetting to think that these things are happening, and they are happening.
And if that and if that fails, then they attack the forensic evidence.
Correct. Yeah. Well, what happens is that typically what will occur is that if a new confession is secured or witness testimony is recanted, then what happens, the post-conviction litigators then have the problem of the forensic evidence that was used at the trial, because now what do you do with that? Scientific evidence doesn't recant itself. It stands on its own. So what these activists will do then is they will start their own campaign, and they usually are successful in getting sympathetic journalists to write their stories for them, talking about, oh my goodness, you know, that this scientist testified in the original trial and they were using an invalid scientific method, or, you know, whatever it may be. And so what happens is it's the big lie theory that if you tell a lie often enough that people will start to believe it. And so what happened, for example, in North Carolina with Gregory Taylor is that as the exoneration wheels got turning for Gregory Taylor, they turned it towards the forensic evidence and started to vilify the employees at the state forensic science center, the SBI, State Bureau of Investigation Crime Laboratory, and it really becomes painful. And so what ends up happening, maybe to kind of distill it down into the simplest form, is that what happens is that these activists involved in post conviction litigation will basically try to create chaos. They want to create chaos, they want to create fog so nothing seems clear anymore, and then the authorities are left with nothing but to say, my goodness, you know, we're just going to let this, you know, it's an exoneration, we're going to let him go. And this creating this fog often requires the discrediting of forensic evidence. And so I think that's how the two are, you know, as you asked the question, that's how the two are correlated with each other.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, yeah. And when they're disputing it as well, they hire their own experts usually, correct?
Yes, they will. They will hire their own experts. And, you know, I know that many of these Innocence Projects will use reputable DNA experts. DNA is really the big one for the Innocence Movement, using DNA to try to show proof of innocence. And they use reputable DNA experts that are, you know, qualified and credentialed, and I don't really have a problem with that. But what happens is that DNA, and this is really important for your listeners to know, is that, and everybody to know, is that DNA and every other kind of forensic evidence has never exonerated anyone and it has never convicted anyone. What happens is that the information that is produced by scientists, you know, forensic scientists, forensic examiners, that information then has to be used by the trial attorneys, the prosecutors, or the defenders to make their case. So what often happens is that once the evidence gets in the hands of the attorneys, that's when things can start to go south. And so even with using reputable forensic science experts in these cases, those scientists don't have control over how the attorneys use it in court and even before trial. So I think that there needs to be some standards of practice for the use of scientific evidence in post-conviction litigation so that it's not intentionally, you know, misused.
Okay. Yeah, it's all very interesting. There's so much to know and there's so much going on. And like you said, when they get reparations for millions of dollars, I mean, those are millions of tax dollars. So this is costing everyone.
It's costing everyone. And look, I mean, I think we would all agree that if somebody truly was innocent and went to prison, that there needs to be some type of release for that individual. But in if you have a situation where you have an overzealous post-conviction litigator or innocence activist that is just hell-bent on getting somebody exonerated, whether to make a name for themselves or to justify the existence of their clinic, you know, whatever it may be, it can end up costing us taxpayers millions of dollars for no reason. And that's why we need to be taking it seriously. And we also have to recognize that the most vocal activists out there are the ones that are trying to make major changes to our criminal justice system. And that's something that we need to take seriously. So the conversation has to get out of the ideological realm, and it has to be brought into more thoughtful, professional conversation about what kind of criminal justice system we want, how we can make it more reliable, and try to put all of this information and all these different factors affecting convictions, put them in the proper context and proportion, because if we don't, we're going to do way more damage to our criminal justice system than we have now, and it's going to end up being worse, not better.
And what do you recommend for the average person to do to learn more about this and to maybe get more involved in discussing this?
Well, what I would do is I would like to see people start writing letters to their editors in the newspapers, in the newsrooms, simply asking them to stop celebrating these innocence activists and these exonerations and start looking at them through a reasonably critical eye and demand that their journalists not assume that somebody that is exonerated deserves to be exonerated. That's number one. The other thing is that people need to pay close attention to what their legislators are doing to make sure that their legislators are not buying into the innocence rhetoric, which many of them are, we know that, and not to have our criminal justice system reformed based on activism campaigns, that these changes and reforms to our criminal justice system, they need to be thoughtful, they need to be evidence-based, and so forth. And then finally, you know, to your question, just pay attention. Pay attention to this. And you can go to crimelabreport.com and find the Innocence Audit page, and we'll continually be updating that. But I would just encourage everybody to pay attention and resist allowing our criminal justice system reformed in the wrong ways.
Yes, yes. Well, thank you so much. So everybody can go to crimelabreport.com or forensicsfoundations.com.
That's right. And, yes. And there's a lot of information there. And I really appreciate you having me on. I enjoyed it.
Yes, thank you. John Collins, thank you so much for being on True Crimes Podcast.
Thank you.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.